there's a election in November, and elections have consequences. But before we talk about that, we should talk about the Torah. And about the Torah portion that we're going to read for these high holidays. So before I even talk about what the Torah portion is, I did mention it last night. It's going to be the Ten Commandments and Congregation Beth Adam. We select different Torah portions throughout the year for the high holidays. We don't read the Binding of Isaac any longer. We read other sections. And I decided the Ten Commandments, that was it this year. Talk about why in a minute. Okay, but let's talk about the Torah before we even get there. So the Torah is a series of stories, legends, tales, myths. It is a myth. It's a document weaving together lots of different pieces. It is not on its face value the history of the Jewish people. This is not an historical document. Right? We all got that. We can talk about that more. That's what religious school is for. September 23rd, it will start, and we can go through this more. But for the moment, you need to understand that. So that's the context in which we do that, but it is a tale. It's like any story. It goes somewhere, and it meanders, and there's bits and pieces. But I want to get you to the Ten Commandments story. So let's sort of think back. The Jews are in Egypt. It says in the beginning of the book of Exodus, there arose a Pharaoh who knew not Joseph. Now, right then, let's just want to correct something. I said something wrong already. And facts do matter. There are no Jews in the Bible. The word Jew wasn't created yet. There were Hebrews, and there were Israelites. And later in the Bible, the word Yehudi comes into use, which means Judean, not Jew. Those are technical differences. I wrote my rabbinic thesis about that. The word Jew in Judaism and selected texts of antiquities. If you have insomnia, raise your hand and you'll get a copy of the thesis afterwards. Okay. It will help you. Okay. So where was? Oh, I know. Okay. Pick up the pace. Okay. So Jews are in Egypt. We're there. Okay. Baby Moses, Pharaoh decides he's going to kill all the Jewish boys. The parents go, oh, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? And they put the child in the River Nile in a basket. Pharaoh's daughter pulls him out, and she raises him as her own. And the child, then the adult Moses, Charlton Heston, is, right? That's who you had in your head. I know that. I mean, it's too obvious. It's too easy. So Charlton Heston's wandering around. He sees a taskmaster striking a slave, and he goes up and he pushes the taskmaster, and, you know, we all rabbis, we like to write stories about that. Did he mean to kill him? Did it was an accident? Whatever. He kills the taskmaster. He buries the taskmaster, and it becomes obvious that people know that this has happened. He gets scared, and he runs away. Where does he run? Runs to the Sinai. He runs to a place. We're going to talk about the place in a second. But the story that we think about is he runs to this different place. He's out with some sheep, right? He's carrying some, and he finds the... Say it again. Perfect. Okay. So where did he find the burning bush? He finds it in the background of his now father-in-law, Jethro. That's where it was found, in Jethro's backyard, right? We tend to think of backyards typically as sort of limited in space, but you have sheep. Your backyard's where you wander your sheep, where you graze them. So he meets God, Yahweh, at this place. He, in fact, has to meet a God who says, I'm really the God that these other people, your ancestors, knew about. It was as if he was actually meeting a new God, which actually, in scholarly circles, raises the tradition and the thought that maybe Moses was in fact meeting, or this was a moment in Jewish history when a new God was being introduced, a Kenite God, because Jethro, who is a Midianite, was actually a high priest. So there's a whole scholarly tradition about who was Moses meeting in the burning bush. Moses standing there, sandals off. God says to Moses out of the burning bush, go back and help free the slaves. So Moses goes back, He is heavy of tongue, it says, so he enlists his brother, Aaron, to help him do that. He does all those tricks, right? We know them. Eventually the plagues, the story of Passover. The Jews leave, and they go to where? Mount Sinai. And there, the mountain's on fire, and God talks again. It's called literary symbolism and symmetry. First, if you look at biblical stories, people who lead people first led animals. It was a motif that the writers of the ancient text used to use to talk about leadership. So Moses had led the sheep to the burning bush. Now he leads his people to a mountain which is on fire. And God gives him the Ten Commandments. So that's where we're at. Moses receiving the Ten Commandments from God. So to remember, elections, there's an election in November, and elections have consequences. So why am I saying that? Because there's an election in November, and they have consequences. I'm also saying that because a lot of people think that I'm injecting politics into the Bible or into the Torah. I am here to tell you that this is a political document. It was written as a political document. It was about leadership. It was about authority. This is as a political document as you can get. And most of us don't know that because we weren't taught that. We learned it as children. A pediatric approach to the stories. Isn't it cute? Isn't it simple? Isn't it easy? But the text beneath it is very, very much about power, about authority, and who's in charge. And if you don't believe me, which really upsets me, I would recommend you could read Dr. David Sperling, a professor at the Hebrew Union College Jewish Institute of Religion, wrote a book, and this book he writes that, quote, the stories in the Torah are, quote, political propaganda composed in the reign of Solomon, David's son and successor, to answer criticism of the monarchy, which in earlier days had made radical changes in Israelite society. So he's saying that the stories that we're reading were written hundreds of years after the events they're supposed to be talking about occurred, in order for a king to justify his authority. It is a political document that's propaganda. I think we need to understand that the issue of politics has been embedded in human experience for a very long time. The way this text was used then, and the way this text is frequently used now, is about politics. We need to understand that that's what our ancestors are doing. Just like politicians today oftentimes want to grab and maintain power, the politicians of yesteryear or the ancient world wanted to do exactly the same thing. So, what election am I thinking about? Some of you may have thought it was a governor's race or maybe a congressional race. It's not what I was thinking about, not for this point. I'm thinking about the people in Alabama who are going to vote on whether or not the Ten Commandments are going to be posted. They are voting to change the rule, that they think that this test is so important, they want to vote whether or not they're going to post it. Now, some of you may go, Alabama, Ten Commandments. I have a vague memory of that. And then the name Roy Moore might jump in your head. Right? Roy Moore ran for Senate, was not successful, but what was he known for before that? He was a Supreme Court justice who posted what? The Ten Commandments in front of the courthouse and was forced to step down, was impeached for violating separation of church and state. Roy Moore claims that the Ten Commandments are eminently important and they're moral foundation of our nation, which begs the question, if there are Ten Commandments and about four or five of them, depending how you read them, have nothing to do with morality, are simply about God, about religion, about the Sabbath, how are these the foundation upon which our nation rests? So the folks in Alabama are going to have to decide the value of this text versus the value of our sacred documents in America, the Constitution, Bill of Rights, separation of church and state. Excuse me. And as I said, elections have consequences. Understand, in Tennessee, they did vote to change something. They voted to say that in every school in Tennessee, there must be a sign that says, "In God we trust." Except they never said in which God, which has created some interesting issues. So, political document, people are voting whether or not this document should be posted because it's upon which our nation found. I disagree. So we call it the Ten Commandments, except even that's a mistake. Even that is a mistake, because we're going to see very quickly that the word commandment doesn't appear in this document. What's the word for commandment? Mitzvah, mitzvot, plural. Doesn't appear here. The number 10 doesn't appear here. It occurs later in the document. Add to this, you know, we have this image of five on one side, five on the other, right? I suppose it's really straightforward. Everyone agrees on it. Couldn't be further from the truth. In the Jewish version, there are 13 sentences. In the Christian version, there are 17 sentences. And it's easily countable that there are 13 commandments. So the math doesn't quite work. So if you were to go and look at the Ten Commandments Roy Moore had put out in front of the State House, or in front of the courthouse, there were 11. He was trying to be ecumenical. So even the text itself, the person who said, "This is so important, we got to put the Ten Commandments out," couldn't figure out which 10 were the 10 he wanted out. Okay. All with me so far? So let me find. Oh, V'dibir Elohim et kol ha'devarim ha'ele le'mor. God spoke all these divarim, words, statements, some version of that. He just said, it doesn't say 10 words or 10 statements. It doesn't use the word commandment. It simply is God said some things. The phrase 10 commandments doesn't come along until the Talmud, which is a legal text much later. And then it continues, Anochi Adonai Elohecha Asher Hotzieticha Me'eretz Mitzrayim Mibeit Avadim. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, the house of bondage. Is that a command? Sounds like an introductory statement. This is who I am, this particular God, and this is what I did. I brought you out of Egypt. Lo yeh lecha Elohim acharim lepanai. And you shall have no other gods before me. Now, help me out here. This is supposed to be a monotheistic document? No other gods before me? Doesn't say I'm the only God. That's why in Tennessee they have a problem. When you say in God we trust, you better be really specific what you're using that word to mean. This text, our Torah, this document that people hold up on a regular basis and claim it's all about monotheism, is not. It presumes the existence of multiple gods, and that the Jewish people are going to be supposed to accept a particular one of those many gods, Yahweh. Now, Karen Armstrong, noted scholar, wrote in The History of God, the idea of the Ten Commandments tells us that the Israelites were not yet monotheists, because this command only makes sense in a polytheistic setting. The Israelites did not believe that Yahweh, the God of Sinai, was the only God, but promised in their covenant that they would ignore all the other deities and worship him alone. This is a polytheistic document that was used for political purposes. And the structure of it is Hittite. This was a legal contract that followed a formula that we can find in other scholarly, in other texts of the ancient Near East. Richard Friedman, in his book about the Torah, talks about this. This is a very specific formulaic approach that we find in ancient documents, where the regional king gives his name. I am the Lord your God. That's the first thing. The regional king says who they are. Then they give a historical prologue. They tell about the relationship between the people writing the contract, the ruler and the subjects. I brought you out of Egypt. That's our relationship. And then in the next part of the contract are the stipulations, the primary one being first, which is you will have no other gods before me. And then all the rest of the pieces of the contract are the subsequent ones. This was a formula, and we can find, actually, in the ancient Near Eastern texts, treaties that look like this, and you never guess what they're inscribed on. Stones. Oftentimes, just like we have, and there are two of them. One is given to the ruler, and one is given to the subjects, and the subjects put it in a special place, maybe like an ark or in a temple, and they put it there because it is important. And in fact, we can find there's Roman treaties that were written on bronze, and they were stored in the capital. It continues, you shall not make for yourself a sculpted image or any likeness of what is in the heavens above or the earth below or in the waters on earth. So Moses was the one who was supposed to accept this. Except when we read the Torah, we have a real problem. Later in the Torah, Moses makes a bronze serpent that people can stand before in case they are bitten and healed. So that begs the question, if the guy who supposedly accepted the Ten Commandments didn't read them because he made an image that was illegal, we have questions. This is why this text is much more interesting when we take it and open it up. We begin to see the nuances of time and that it's a weaving together of many different things. The next verse, or the next commandment, if you will, is very problematic. It says, you shall not bow down to them, these graven images, or serve them, for I am the Lord your God, an impassioned God, visiting the guilt of the parents upon the children, upon the third and upon the fourth generations of those who reject me. Think about that. A just God who then says, if you do something wrong, your great-grandchildren will suffer. That punishment is visited onward. So the question of the morality of this document is significant. And people hold it up and want to use it and say it becomes the foundation of what we are doing. We need to question that. Jeff Sessions, isn't it amazing how politics and religion just seem to go together? And I'm not, it was. So for those of you who thought this took a long time, this didn't. All you do is you type in 10 commandments and 10 commandments, religion and politics, and it gets interwoven because the politics of it were in when they wrote it and continues to be played out. Because what is it about? Power and authority. And how people quote from it and use it is incredibly important. So Jeff Sessions on his senatorial website had written, the Ten Commandments represent a key part of the foundation of Western civilization of our legal system in America. To exclude a display of the Ten Commandments, because it suggests an establishment of religion, is inconsistent with our national history, let alone common sense itself. Okay. This nation was founded on religious traditions that are an integral part of the fabric of American culture, political, and societal life. That's one particular way to approach the Ten Commandments and how they're often used. I would suggest there's another way to look at these same texts. And another famous American who unfortunately is no longer well known, whose name probably is lost to many people, Robert Ingersoll. Nod your head if you know Robert Ingersoll. Probably the most listened to person before the advent of the motion picture or the radio or the TV, the most heard American before those things were invented. Lived in the end of the 1800s, Civil War veteran, lawyer, child of a minister, Republican. Gave a major speech called the King Bloom, gave a big speech at a convention. Major lecturer. Spoke in Cincinnati. He spoke across America. People would come to hear him speak. They literally would sell out theaters to hear him speak. He wrote, some lawyers and some eminent judges have said and still say that the Ten Commandments are the foundation of all law. Nothing could be more absurd. Long before these commandments were given, there were codes of law in India and in Egypt, laws against murder, perjury, larceny, adultery, and fraud. Such laws are as old as human society, as old as the love of life, as old as industry, as the idea of prosperity, as old of human love. All of the Ten Commandments that are old, all the Ten Commandments that are good, Ingersoll said, were old, and all that were new are foolish. If God had been civilized, he would have left out the commandment about keeping the Sabbath, and in its place he would have said, "Thou shalt not enslave thy fellow man." He would have left out the one about graven images, and instead he would have said, "Thou shalt not wage wars of extermination, and thou shalt not unsheathe the sword except in self-defense." Ingersoll said, all that we call progress, the enfranchisement of man, of labor, the substitution of imprisonment for death, a fine for imprisonment, the establishing of free speech, of the rights of the conscience, in short, all that has tended to the development and the civilization of man, all the results of investigation, observation, experience, and free thought, all that man has accomplished for the benefit of man since the close of the Dark Ages, has been done in spite of the Bible. So no, as we read the Ten Commandments, as we study this text, that religion and politics are nothing new. Ingersoll was speaking about it at the end of the 1800s. Biblical writers were fighting about it even as they wrote the text we read from this day. And we are doing the same. Remember, elections are in November, and they have consequences.